Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and once again, welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to look at one particular thing, the significance of Churchill's speech to the Houses of Parliament on the 4th of June 1940, at the aftermath of the Dunkirk evacuation, better known as the Fight Them on the Beaches speech. So without further ado, we're going to listen to some of it now.
When Napoleon lay at Boulogne for a year with his flat-bottomed boats and his grand army, he was told by someone, "There are bitter weeds in England. There are certainly a great many more of them since the British expeditionary force returned. Sir, I have myself full confidence that if all do their duty, if nothing is neglected, and if the best arrangements are made, as they are being made, we shall prove ourselves once more able to defend our island home, to ride out the storm of war, and to outlive the menace of tyranny, if necessary for years, if necessary alone. At any rate, that is what we are going to try to do. That is the resolve of His Majesty's government, every man of them. That is the will of Parliament and the nation, the British Empire and the French Republic, linked together in their cause and in their need, will defend to the death their native soil, aiding each other like good comrades to the utmost of their strength. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight on the landing grounds, we shall fight in the fields and in the streets, we shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender, and if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the new world, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old."
This was one of three speeches. It was the second. The first that Churchill had given was on the 13th of May, the Blood, Toil, Tears and Sweat speech, which was his maiden speech as Prime Minister to the Commons. And then on the 18th of June, following the high point of the Battle of Britain — by no means at this point was the Battle of Britain over — he gave the Finest Hour speech. And these three speeches together were kind of almost a Churchillian manifesto to the Commons, to the nation, and to Britain's allies around the world. So he'd taken over, as we know, if you listen to the previous podcast, on the 10th of May. which was right at the end of the Norway disaster and at the very beginnings of Hitler's attack on Belgium, the Netherlands, Luxembourg, and then France. And the blood, toil, tears, and sweat speech was given obviously within this context. At this point, Churchill didn't really think that the British Expeditionary Force was going to be routed within under a month. He thought that there would probably be an offensive rather like that in 1914, rather like the Schlieffen Plan, that the British Expeditionary Force, the Germans would try to cut off the Channel ports, and the reality is that there are certain similarities between the Schlieffen Plan and the Manstein Plan, in that it relies on encirclement and the quick seizure of Paris. But unfortunately for the British and the French, they are drawn into a trap in Belgium. And by the 28th of Belgium, the King of Belgium has thrown in the towel. He fears a further devastation of his country and what happened in the previous war. And this means that British on their right flank are in, or their eastern flank are in serious trouble. There's that part of their defences has collapsed. This is what initiates really the retreat to Dunkirk. Once the Belgians are capitulate, it becomes clear to the French that the British might then cut and run. Anglo-French trust breaks down to the point that actually you have skirmishes between British and French soldiers. I mean, this is a kind of an outlier event, but it gives us a picture of how things were. Skirmishes between British and French soldiers as they were making for ships to disembark them. Not at Dunkirk, but at other disembarkation points. Churchill was fearing the worst by the 28th of May. He made a statement to the Commons that day saying, "Meanwhile, the House should prepare itself for hard and heavy tidings. I have only to add that nothing which may happen in this battle can in any way relieve us of our duty to defend the world cause to which we have vowed ourselves, nor should it destroy our confidence in our power to make our way, as on former occasions in our history, through disaster and through grief, to the ultimate defeat of our enemies." The actual Fight Them on the Beaches speech is, very little of it is rousing sentiment. Much of it is a long-winded and detailed account of Dunkirk that tries to, for example, relieve criticism of the Royal Air Force. And Churchill points out that actually the Royal Air Force, contrary to what the troops on the ground were thinking, wasn't doing nothing. It was actually fighting extremely hard to force the Luftwaffe back. The statement on the 4th of June is, as I said, it's an account of events that was promised to Parliament, and in the delivery, with many sort of Churchillian flourishes of defiance that were designed to boost morale in Britain, but also send a clear message across the Atlantic that Britain was not caving. The speech actually develops into one of the great pieces of 20th century oratory. Now, the mythmakers of this period of time, British propagandists and the Ministry for Information, strongly suggested that Churchill's speech managed to galvanise the nation. And this has been a kind of a Hollywood standby ever since. It's a delightful myth, but unfortunately it's not really true. Mass observation reports show that morale did not dramatically increase as a result of the speech. Simple fact is that the British Expeditionary Force has been forced out of France without its equipment and has come home in retreat, and it has been a huge humiliation inflicted on Britain, and a great many people were inspecting invasion themselves next, an invasion which they saw as really being would certainly be the end of Great Britain and the end of the society which they knew and valued. So half the population of Britain thought that Britain would fight on, so 50% of people. And most of them thought, well, this is not really a war fought by or in the interests of ordinary people. This is a war between elite groups, people like Churchill. Churchill himself had a very unpopular 20s and 30s. He was seen as out of step on issues such as the abdication of Edward VIII. He was out of step on issues such as the reintroduction of the gold standard. He was unpopular when it came to the question of India, and seen as an anachronism, as India, as the appetite for home rule in India was to some extent shared in Great Britain as well, as seeing a kind of a progressive and modern change for the British Empire. Winston Churchill, the aristocrat, was not necessarily in keeping with public the increasing egalitarianism and collectivism of British public life and British public attitudes from the 1930s onwards. And this would manifest itself in its most starkest in 1945 when he loses the general election. But Churchill was nothing if not consistent in his speech writing. The constant theme of Britain being alone, Britain committing to whatever punishment was meted out, and Britain fighting on single-mindedly to victory was there in the May 13th speech. He said, "We have before us an ordeal of the most grievous kind."
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
We have before us many, many long months of struggle and suffering. You ask, what is our policy? I will say, it is to wage war by sea, land and air, with all our might and with all the strength that God can give us, to wage war against the monstrous tyranny never suppressed in the dark, lamentable catalogue of human crime. That is our policy. You ask, what is our aim? I can answer in one word. It is victory. Victory at all costs. Victory in spite of all terror. Victory however long and hard the road may be. At that point, one of the appeals of Churchill's oratory is that he offered a simple and clear direction for the war. The question after Dunkirk of, well, what do we do now, is ably answered by Churchill. It's not popular in all quarters, but certainly it's clear and unambiguous. Now, previously, in an earlier podcast this week, I've talked about how, it was Monday's podcast, in fact, I've talked about how Churchill was speaking to the United States. Two views of Churchill, Joseph Kennedy, or two views of Great Britain, Joseph Kennedy, the ambassador to Great Britain, his was that really the British would cave following Dunkirk. But Sumner Wells, the assistant to the Secretary of State, said that he was certain that the British would fight on. And the recipient of this information is obviously Franklin Roosevelt. And Roosevelt was able to err on the Wells side of things when Churchill made his speech. And the idea that the British were a kind of a lost cause is slowly dissipated. Roosevelt describes the speech as firmness itself. And Cordell Hull said, "The President and I believe Mr. Churchill meant what he said. There would be no negotiations between London and Berlin." So this is diplomacy by speech at its most effective. And this is the real flair that Churchill had. You know, I've mentioned many times before that Churchill makes all sorts of ludicrous mistakes during the war. But his ability in oratory did less to inspire the nation than it did to inspire other world leaders that the British were sticking to their guns no matter what. And even when situations are extremely difficult, like 1940, once you have a world leader who is clear and unambiguous and is not going to waver, and the foreign powers can have some kind of faith in that, then you're on a much, much better basis for a relationship or even an alliance. And this was Churchill's game all along. Churchill knew that the war without America was lost, that the British needed to distinguish themselves for long enough to show that they had fight in them and show that they were willing to commit and sacrifice in order for an opportunity to bring America into the war. But ultimately, the war couldn't be won without the USA. Churchill was in a privileged position to do this. And his mother, the American heiress, Lady Jenny Jerome, enabled him to play on his Anglo-American heritage. Churchill had visited America many times. He had been there at the time of the Wall Street crash to look upon his own investments on Wall Street. And he understood American sensibilities quite well. And he knew that his role really was there to charm the American people, which he did through radio broadcasts and then visits to America and to addresses to Congress. And much of this helped to negate the more negative view that the very influential Ambassador Kennedy propagated about Britain's chances in the early stages of the war. And much of this was in part due to the fact that that Kennedy had his own deeply Anglophobic points of view and disliked Britain greatly. Roosevelt always had a soft spot for Great Britain. Anyway, Roosevelt was dismayed at appeasement in the 1930s, and that was an interesting mirror of British views about American isolationism and the view that the British really should be the regional hegemon or the regional power in Europe, Roosevelt thought, and should be dealing with Europe's rogue states. Roosevelt wrote in 1939 about the British fatalist attitude and the kind of bleak outlook in Britain. "I wish the British would stop this 'we who are about to die salute the' attitude. What the British need today is a good stiff grog, inducing not only the desire to save civilization, but the continued belief that they can do it. In such an event, they will have a lot more support from their American cousins." And whilst Roosevelt deeply disliked Kennedy and referred to him as an appeaser, and suspected that Kennedy would quite like a deal between Britain and Nazi Germany, and indeed the USA and Nazi Germany, to be struck, the importance of what he had to say could not simply be dismissed. The weakness of Britain's position at the time couldn't be made up by simply martial spirit alone. On May the 28th, 1940, Lord Halifax decided that it was probably best to impress upon Churchill the importance of taking up Mussolini's offer to mediate between Hitler and the British government. And whilst Chamberlain, who had been politically discredited and stripped of his leadership role, he was still there and still emphatic that this was probably the only thing that Britain could do. He said, "Britain should be ready to consider decent terms if such were offered to us." And Churchill's perhaps fourth great speech of that year followed soon afterwards to Cabinet. He said, "Every man of you would rise up and tear me down from my place if I were for one moment to contemplate parley or surrender. If this long island history of ours is to end, let it end only when each one of us lies choking in his own blood upon the ground." On May the 15th, Churchill had already written to Roosevelt and said, "As you are no doubt aware, the scene has darkened swiftly. The enemy has a marked preponderance in the air. The small countries are simply smashed up one by one, like matchwood. We expect to be attacked here ourselves, both from the air and by parachute, and airborne troops in the near future are getting ready for them. If necessary, we shall continue the war alone, and we are not afraid of that. But I trust you realise, Mr. President, that the voice and force of the United States may count for nothing if they are withheld too long. You may have a completely subjugated, Nazified Europe established with astonishing swiftness, and the weight may be more than we can bear. Immediate needs are, first of all, the loan of 40 or 50 of your older destroyers. Secondly, we want several hundred of the latest types of aircraft. Thirdly, anti-aircraft equipment and ammunition. Fourthly, we need to purchase steel in the United States. This also applies to other materials. We shall go on paying for dollars, dollars for as long as we can, but I should like to feel reasonably sure that when we can pay no more, you will give us the stuff all the same. Fifthly, the visit of a United States squadron to Irish ports, which might well be prolonged, would be invaluable. Sixth, I am looking for you to keep that Japanese dog quiet in the Pacific." Churchill was showing all his cards, and there weren't many of them. It was a letter where there was almost a plea for help. It was presumptuous, it was brazen, and it was really put Roosevelt in a very powerful position in the beginning of their relationship. On June the 15th, again he wrote, "I know well, Mr. President, that your eye will have already searched these depths, but I feel I have the right to place on record the vital matter in which American interests are at stake in our battle," adding that Britain would become a vassal state of the Hitler Empire and there would be a gift of the British fleet to Germany in the process. "At the moment," said Churchill, "overwhelming sea power would be in Hitler's hands." So there were a variety of means of communicating between Churchill and Roosevelt. Churchill's speeches, declaring resolute steadfastness in the face of evil, but also blackmail. Churchill used showed Roosevelt what he wanted and also outlined the consequences of Roosevelt not giving these things to him. And later on, when we talk about the Arsenals of Democracy speech, it's been a while since we've done that one, so I think we'll redo it. The key themes that Churchill's bringing up are clearly in Roosevelt's thoughts and are transmitted to the American people. Anyway, I hope you found this useful. I will be setting up a Patreon page for Explaining History, so if there's anybody out there that would like to contribute and contribute a tiny sum a month to keep us going with some of the ongoing costs we have, that would be very gratefully received, and more on that soon.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more.
and is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.